In our study this morning, we're continuing to study from Romans, the first chapter, and we noted in the theme of the book, it is described beginning in verse 16 of the first chapter. The apostle had expressed in verse 14 that he is debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to the foolish. Verse 15, so that as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you also that are in Rome. He says in verse 16 then, for I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God and the salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith. In these verses, the writer sets the theme for the book of Romans, establishing in the first chapter that the Gentiles are guilty of sin. Beginning into the second chapter, he likewise establishes that the Jew is guilty of sin. And then in the third chapter, in verse 23, he points out that all have fallen short of the glory of God, that all have sinned. But the solution to sin is found within the gospel. In verse 17, he says, for therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Revealed within the gospel is God's means to make man righteous. We studied in our last study, beginning at verse 18, how that God had made known Himself in the creation itself. That as man looks at the things that God has created, he can perceive God's everlasting power and divinity. In the first chapter, he describes a number of things that the Gentiles were guilty of that caused them to be without excuse for not recognizing the glory of God. He says in verse 21, because that knowing God, they glorified Him not as God, neither gave thanks, but became vain in their reasonings. We describe those in the Ephesian letter, the fourth chapter, and in verse 17, as the writer is primarily discussing the condition of the Gentiles, how that the Gentiles likewise became vain in their reasonings and lived a reprobate life. In verse 22, continuing in Romans chapter 1, he said they became vain in their reasoning and their senseless heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. We noted in the first chapter of the book of 1 Corinthians how that there were those who exalted their will and their wisdom above the will and wisdom and the revelation of God. And they likewise became fools. But these, professing themselves to be wise, became fools. In Psalms, the 14th chapter, and in verse 1, the fool has said in his heart that there is no God. And so it was with these Gentiles in Rome who had abandoned the knowledge of God. In verse 23 of Romans chapter 1, it says, they changed the glory of the incorruptible God for the likeness of an image of corruptible man, and of birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. What is it that the Gentiles did that Paul is identifying in this and the next few verses? What is it that the Gentiles engaged in? Ken?
Idols.
All right. They had engaged in idol worship. They had created their own idols which they worshiped, and in verse 24 we find an expression that occurs three times in the next few verses, wherefore God gave them up. He gave them up to practice the things they were determined to practice. Chris, I know you and I have talked about that. Would you like to discuss just a little further about the expression that God gave them up?
Mm-hmm. But eventually God had a
All right.
And God was going to make this world known to him. But again, the point is, if we're persistent, if we're going to continue to seek whatever pleases us, God will allow us to find that, and we'll reap the consequences.
That's right. And so it was among the Ephesians in the fourth chapter, when they practiced the vanity of their mind, being darkened in their understanding. In verse 19 of the fourth chapter of Ephesians, it says, "Who being past feelings, gave themselves up to lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness." The writer identifies they had no conscience about the wrong things that they were practicing. And God allows us to reach such a state. What becomes the contingency upon which God allows us to pursue such a course? In the 2 Thessalonian letter, the writer says, beginning at verse 10, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 10. He says, "And with all deceit of unrighteousness, for them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God sendeth them a working of error, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be judged who believe not the truth, but have pleasure in unrighteousness." If our love is not for those things that are right, God will allow us to believe a lie, and, as Chris said, to ultimately suffer the consequences. Balaam had a lesson to learn, and the people of Israel had a lesson to learn from the error that Balaam advanced. But God will allow us to believe error if we do not love the truth. And so it was with the Gentiles in Rome. They were without excuse. God gave them up in the lust of their hearts unto uncleanness, that their bodies should be dishonored among themselves. For that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Now, we talked about the folly of worshiping idols. We noticed in Psalms chapter 115, verses 4 through verse 8, what it means to worship an idol and the foolishness or the folly of worshiping an idol. Turn, if you will, to Psalms chapter 115. Psalms chapter 115. And begin reading, if you would, please, at verse 4. As he describes the idols of these heathen people, he said, "Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. They that make them shall be like unto them, and every one that trusteth in them." The will of an idol becomes the will of the man who worships the idol. And so it is that God gives them up to uncleanness, and that their bodies should be dishonored among themselves, that they exchange the truth of God for a lie. Now, as the prophet Isaiah writes, he likewise describes the foolishness of worshiping an idol. In Isaiah chapter 44, he describes the man who goes out into the woods and cuts down a tree. And as he cuts down the tree, he builds from the tree an idol and falls down before it. But from the remainder of the tree, he builds a fire to warm himself and to cook his food. How foolish that is, to think that the same tree can be destroyed in a fire and that he can fall down and worship the remnants of it. What a foolish notion that is, as Isaiah describes in chapter 44. But even as God gave them up to practice these evil things, it tells us in verse 26, "For this cause God gave them up unto vile passions." What is vile passions? Well, he describes some of them in this context. Vile passions are those of dishonor. He says, "For..." And we notice that this word "for" introduces a reason. Why were they given up unto vile passions? "For their women changed the natural use into that which is against nature, and likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men, working unseemliness, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was due. God gave them up to practice sins of dishonor. And then he begins to describe some of those that are also characterized in the Old Testament text. If you would please turn, if you would, to Leviticus, the 18th chapter, where we see in the law of Moses, Leviticus, the 18th chapter, where God addressed the same thing and expressed the consequences to be revealed unto those of Israel. Leviticus, the 18th chapter. Reading beginning at verse 22. No, verse 21. It says, "And thou shalt not give any of thy seed to make them pass through the fire of Molech, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am Jehovah. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination. Thou shalt not lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion." We're studying this morning from Romans chapter 1 in verses 26 through verse 27, where God gave the Gentiles up to practice vile passions. And we notice that among those passions are described the practices of homosexuality. In Romans, or in Leviticus rather, the 20th chapter, we see the consequences are imposed for such practices. Beginning in verse 13 of Leviticus chapter 20, it says, "And if a man lie with mankind, as with womankind, both of them have committed abomination, they shall surely be put to death, their blood shall be upon them. And if man take a wife and her mother, it is wickedness, they shall be burnt with fire, both he and they, that there be no wickedness among you. And if man lie with beast, he shall surely be put to death, and ye shall slay the beast. And if a woman approach unto any beast to lie down thereto, thou shalt kill the woman and the beast, they shall surely be put to death, their blood shall be upon them." Now these in Romans chapter 1, God gave them up to practice such dishonorable practices. God gave them up, as we'll notice in verse 28, unto a reprobate mind. That is, to practice those things that are an abomination. But in verse 27 of this text, it says that recompense of their error which was due. That is, that they may receive the consequences, the recompense of their error which was due. God holds men accountable. There is no man, regardless of the things that he practices, no man, regardless of the things that he knows or that he does not know, who is not accountable unto God. We ask the question sometimes, what about the man who doesn't have a Bible? What about the man who does not know God? What about the man who does not know that there is a Son of God through which redemption can be enjoyed? That man is bound by God's law. In Romans the 4th chapter and in verse 15, Romans the 4th chapter in verse 15, the Apostle Paul, writing just a little further over than our text, says, "For the law worketh wrath, but where there is no law, neither is there transgression." God held the Gentiles accountable for the things that they practiced, which indicates that the Gentiles were held accountable and would be judged by God's law. Now, as we get into the second chapter, the question is going to be asked, what law were the Gentiles under? And we'll notice that indeed they were under law, for which God held them accountable, that they would receive the recompense of the error which was due unto them. Further in the Roman letter, if you'll turn over just a few pages to Romans the 12th chapter, and notice in verse 19, Romans chapter 12, verse 19, the Apostle Paul continues, "Avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place unto the wrath of God. For it is written, Vengeance belongeth unto me. I will recompense, saith the Lord." Man cannot practice sin without consequence. There are eternal consequences to the practice of sin that we read about in the great judgment scene beginning in Matthew chapter 25. These shall go away unto eternal punishment, but these shall go unto eternal life. Verse 46, or is it verse 47 of Matthew chapter 25? 46, I believe. You want to check that for me? Matthew 25, verse 46. But as we see these Gentiles in Romans chapter 1, they would receive consequences of their sins. For indeed they were under law. In Romans chapter 11, in verse 30, for as ye in time past were disobedient, but now have obtained mercy by their disobedience, even so have these also now been disobedient, that by the mercy shown unto you, they also may now obtain mercy. These Gentiles who practiced sin would not do so without consequence, but they could in Christ obtain mercy and enjoy the forgiveness of their sins. One of the things that we want to notice about these Gentiles in our text of Romans chapter 1, if you'll turn back to that, we notice in verse 28 it tells us, and even as they refused to have God in their knowledge. Had these Gentiles known God? Yes, they had. We see that they had known of the existence of God even by looking at His creation. But had they a knowledge of the will of God? Yes, they did. We notice in this same passage, not only did they refuse to have knowledge or knowledge of God, but in verse 29, it says, God gave them up to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not fitting. They had a knowledge of God. In verse 32, it tells us, who knowing the ordinance of God. This little expression, ordinance, implies regulations. They knew the commandments of God. In chapter 2, in verse 26, we find that expression again. If therefore the uncircumcision, who was that, by the way? The Gentiles. If therefore the uncircumcision keep the ordinances of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be reckoned for circumcision? Now that implies that those who were uncircumcised had the privilege to keep the ordinances of God. They knew those ordinances. They knew what God had commanded them. But they chose to not have God in their knowledge. And so consequently, God gave them up. He gave them up to practice those things which are not fitting. In verse 28, it says, unto a reprobate mind. That is, a mind not standing the test. To a reprobate mind, a mind that had rejected the knowledge of God, to do those things which are not fitting. Some translations, I believe, or at least the definition of the word not fitting, simply means that which is abominable. It tells us how that God felt about the things that they were practicing, those things which were not fitting. Now, some translations use a milder word, those things that were not convenient. I think the American Standard Translation gives us that a little bit better, those things which are not fitting. And then beginning in verse 29, he begins to describe at some length the things that they practiced. In verse 29, God gave them up to be filled with all unrighteousness. What is unrighteousness? What? A wrong relationship with God. It's defined simply as injustice. They practice things without justice, a wrong relationship with God. Further, it tells us that God gave them up to practice wickedness. What does that imply? We use these words sometimes very commonly, sometimes too common to really express the definitions of the words. What is it to practice wickedness? Pardon me? Evil, yes. To purposely do wrong, that is right. Some have described it as uniform depravity. They're practicing those things without a knowledge of God because they have abandoned the knowledge of God. And then this little word, covetousness. They practiced covetousness. What is that? Exactly right. You want to have things that other people have. maliciousness. An ugly word. They practiced maliciousness. That's very simply a desire to hurt somebody. You hate somebody so much that you're malicious toward them. And we see evidence of that in a host of passages. For example, we see in the Ephesian letter, the 4th chapter, that maliciousness is described as something that is to be put away. Let all bitterness, verse 31. No, verse 29. Let no speech or corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but such as is good for edifying, that or as the need may be, that it may give grace to them that hear. Don't have the desire to hurt somebody, to say malicious things. In Colossians, the 3rd chapter, in verse 8, and a host of New Testament passages, talk about this ill will, the desire to hurt somebody. These things need to be put away. In verse 31 of Ephesians chapter 4, the writer said, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and railing be put away from you with all malice, and be ye kind one to another, tender hearted, forgiving each other, even as God also in Christ forgave you. To wish somebody ill will, the desire to hurt somebody, is the attitude that the Gentiles had. But further we notice, going back to Romans chapter 1, not only does he describe maliciousness, but he describes these as being full of envy. Full of envy. What does that mean? All right, jealousy. You're not happy that other folks are happy. Conceived in the sight of excellence. When you see somebody that's doing well, you're not happy with that. You envy them. And murder. Perhaps that doesn't need any explanation. Simply slaughter. That's how the word is defined. They continued in strife. What is strife? Backbiting, fussing, wrangling, contention, deceit. Now some of you who like to fish ought to know the meaning of that word. What is deceit? Well, that's what you're trying to do to the fish, isn't it? You're trying to deceive the fish into believing that what you have on the end of the line is something that's good for him. And so he bites on it and he is unaware of the fact there's a hook in it. Yes, Richard?
In fact, Strong, in his definition, uses the term bait.
All right, exactly right. Bait. So that's what you do when you go fishing. You bait the fish to try to catch him on something that is deceitful. And that's what these Gentiles were practicing. They practiced deceit. Malignity. What is that? We think of these words and we see them in this list, but rarely do we ever go down through the list to see what they mean. Malignity simply means a bad character. Somebody who has a bad heart. Someone who is subtle. And they practice these things to the destruction of others. And that's what the Gentiles practiced. God gave them up to practice these things. Further, they were guilty of whispering. Now, when you think of whispering, you don't always think of someone who speaks with a quiet voice, do you? What does it mean to be a whisperer, Ken? A gossiper, that's right. Someone who engaged in secret slander. And when you think of a backbiter, these words are very similar. But it's someone who speaks evil. Someone who defames your character. Someone who wants to be a character assassin. Hateful to God perhaps doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot of, or need a whole lot of definition, but it's someone who is exceptionally impious, someone who is exceptionally ungodly, and someone who is insolent. Sometimes we use that word. What does it mean? Very similar to the next word we're going to look at. Someone who's insolent. Somebody who's lifted up with pride. Someone who heaps insulting language upon somebody else. Somebody who engages in that which is shameful and wrong. And someone who is haughty. What is haughty?
Arrogant.
Arrogant, exactly right. In the book of Romans, just a little bit further over, in the 12th chapter, beginning at verse 3, Romans chapter 12, verse 3, the apostle writes, For I say through the grace that was given me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but so to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to each man a measure of faith. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. The Bible speaks very elaborately regarding those who are arrogant. God hates that attitude. He despises it. And yet we find that often men are characterized by being haughty. These of the Gentile world that the Apostle speaks of in Romans chapter 1 were haughty. They were boastful. Now those two terms, you see, are very closely related to each other. But a boastful person is an empty pretender. Somebody who pretends to be something that he's not and then brags about it. And so we see that these two terms are very closely related. Inventors of evil things. Now that really probably doesn't need a whole lot of explanation. But an inventor of evil things is someone who is a conniving person. Someone who paints a picture of something that he wants to pursue and then uses underhanded means in order to pursue it. He is a conniver. And then if you'll notice, in the next portion of the text, disobedient to parents. Disobedient to parents. What does that mean? Rebellious. We notice in a host of passages how that children are to be obedient unto their parents. In the Ephesian letter, in the 6th chapter, perhaps one that is more pronounced than others, in verse 1 it tells us, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth." Further in that text, he gives admonition to those who are fathers. But children, be obedient unto your parents. And if you'll notice in the next expression, he says, without understanding. Without understanding. Because a wicked man has no mind or desire to understand the things of salvation, he separates himself from those things. These in Rome, God gave them up to be without understanding. And you can see why. If you'll notice in the previous verses, they had a knowledge of God, but they did not want to comply with the commandments of God. Verse 32, likewise following. The passage identifies them as knowing the ordinance of God, but they did not retain God in their minds. In verses 18 and 19 and 20 of this same text, we notice how that God had made some things about Himself known. He had revealed His everlasting power and divinity. But they didn't understand these things. They didn't take those things to heart. They had no mind for those things. The writer goes on to describe those who are covenant breakers. What is a covenant breaker? Somebody who breaks their promises. Very simply, that's so. Turn back to the Old Testament text of Ecclesiastes. The wisdom writer in Ecclesiastes, I believe it's chapter 5, says beginning in verse 4, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 4, he says, "When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for He hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou vowest. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow, than that thou shouldest vow and not pay it. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? For in the multitude of dreams there are vanities, and in many words, but fear thou God." It's better not to make a promise at all than it is to make a promise and not keep it. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Let your yea be yea, and your nay be nay." You do what you say you will do. But the Gentiles didn't practice that. We notice even among the Jews there were some who said, "Because we swore by the temple and we didn't swear by heaven, then we don't have to keep that promise." They believed that if they swore by lesser things, then they were not obligated by the thing they said they would do. But yet God binds us by our word. Do what you say you will do. The Gentiles had no regard for that. They were covenant breakers. They were without natural affection. Now perhaps that word doesn't need a great deal of explaining. It simply means without family love. They had no natural affection. When you look at those who commit the sin of abortion, those who abandon children, they are without natural affection. And that's what the writer describes. That was a condition, or a practice rather, of the Gentiles. We noted a few moments ago a text that talked about how that parents would deliver their children unto Molech. We noticed that Molech, of course, was an idol that even the children of Israel at times worshipped in their past. What was an act of worship that was given unto Molech? They burned their children. They were without natural affection. They would burn their children. Now, as we think of even temporal applications of that, many years ago when I was growing up on the farm, we had a cow that got sick. The cow had a newborn calf. The cow died, and the calf would go to the corner of the field where the cow died and just bawl. Now, you're familiar with that, aren't you? What do you suppose that even that young animal felt and understood? Natural affection. It's amazing to me that sometimes animals care for their young in a way that sometimes people do not. These Gentiles cared not for their families. They were without natural affection. Further, it says they were unmerciful. What's that mean? You say without mercy. Let's take that a step further. They were unmerciful. They didn't care. That's right. They had no compassion for those things and those people that they ought to have had compassion for. Some have described the text of Romans chapter 1, verses 28 through verse 32, as the roll call of the damned. And indeed it is. Because we see that these Gentiles were given up to practice ungodly practices. And God gave them up to do those things, as was mentioned about Balaam, because that's what they wanted to do. They could practice these things in the worship of their idols, and God would allow them to do those things. One other note that I wanted to express, and it passed me by, regarding covenant breakers. In Colossians 3 and in Ephesians 4, both of those passages deal with the idea in verse 25 of Ephesians 4 and in verse 9 of Colossians 3 that we're not to lie to each other. These Gentiles were careless with the truth, if I may say that gently. In other words, they were liars. They had no regard for those things that were right. Now, when we engage in a marriage ceremony and we stand before God and our friends and relatives and promise them the loyalty of our lives, and then we break that covenant, are we any less a covenant breaker as we read concerning the characteristics of the Gentiles? Back years ago, a man expressed why that he would not have a divorced person working for him. And he made that as a criteria. Somebody asked him why. He said, if a man will stand before God and all of his family and lie, he said, I don't want that person to work for me because I don't want a liar to work in my business. And I believe the man has a point. Lying in a business, lying in any respect, is to be a covenant breaker, without natural affection, unmerciful. I want you to notice that in verse 32, he says, they that practice such things. That little expression, such things, implies that this list was not intended to be an exhaustive list. Those who practice these kind of things, the writer says, are worthy of death. I want to ping again on that little expression in verse 32, who knowing the ordinance of God. These Gentiles had known full well that these practices were wrong. But they are determined to practice these things anyway. And God gave them up to practice these things. Now, further in this text of chapter 2, we're going to be talking about the conscience of man. Do you believe that these Gentiles, that God had given up to the practices of these things, that they had a conscience about these practices? Originally they did, but at this point in time, God has given them up to practice these things without their conscience smiting them. David? That's right.
And it seems like, of course, they had the mind that didn't want to be obedient to God, so therefore they chose an idol as their God of some kind.
That's right. And so the will of man becomes the will of the idol. Yes, Gary?
This ought to be one of the most sobering passages to us as Christians, because it's easy for us in verses 18 through 27 to sit back and read about and appreciate God's wrath being revealed against these horrible, heinous things. But the passage doesn't stop at verse 27.
No.
It links things that should be closer to home for us: strife, unloving, dishonesty, envy. And it puts that in context when you get to verse 32, lest we be too Pharisaical. This passage applies to us.
It does indeed. There is an application. And this list is not only containing things that we see here characteristic of the Gentiles, but we see similar lists that are addressed to even those who are of Jewish background. For example, if you'll turn over to the Galatian letter and notice there that the primary subjects of the Galatian letter and the primary problem that existed among those Galatian churches was a desire to return to the practices of the law. But in Galatians chapter 5, you'll notice beginning at verse 16, to these who had a Jewish background, he says, "But I say, walk not by the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. For these are contrary the one to the other, that ye may not do the things that ye would. But if ye are led by the Spirit, ye are not under the law," that is, the law of Moses. "Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousies, wrath, factions, divisions, parties, envyings, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of which I forewarn you, even as I did forewarn you, that they who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God." Here were some who ought to have known better. Those who had the law in their history. These Gentiles did not have, as we'll study in the second chapter, a codified law that was written like the Jews did. But the Jews had knowledge of these things, even as God had revealed these things in time past unto the Gentiles. And you're right, these things ought to hit home. These things were things that even plagued the churches of Galatia, the churches of the church in Ephesus, that had a Gentile background. These were very real things that plagued Christians. And unless we understand that, we'll not make the application as we ought to make. Any other question or comment? Let's notice specifically then in verse 32, these knew the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death. They not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. It's not only wrong to engage in these practices, but to have a compassionate, sympathetic attitude toward those who do is also sinful. Sometimes we hear brethren say, "Well, I don't do that." Well, but I am with those who do. I take my best friends from those who do. Remember, the Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, that evil companions corrupt good morals. If we select from the world the closest of our companionship, then we're likely to practice the same things that they did. Turn, if you will, to Acts, the 22nd chapter. where we read the writings of Luke regarding the statements of the Apostle Paul. I find it fascinating how that Paul said in Acts chapter 22 and in verse 20, as he is speaking to the Jewish people regarding his former practices. He says in verse 20 of Acts chapter 22, "And when the blood of Stephen, thy witness, was shed, I also was standing by and consenting and keeping the garments of them that slew him. And he said unto me, Depart, I will send thee forth far hence unto the Gentiles." Saul, formerly, but in this instance the Apostle Paul, says, "Here's what I did. When Stephen was stoned to death, I stood by." Jonathan, there's your sermon. Paul was standing by as he watched Stephen stoned to death. Did he escape any consequence or guilt in standing by, though he didn't take up the stones, but he held the garments of those who did? He gave his consent, he says, to those who stoned Stephen to death. We see that record recorded in Acts chapter 8 for us, beginning in verse 1. It says, "And Saul was consenting unto his death." The former verses identifying the stoning of Stephen to death. Saul said, "I was there. I saw what happened. I consented to what happened." He gave his permission, as it was, by his presence to the very things that happened to Stephen. So in the first chapter, we read of those things that the Gentiles practiced. And the writer says, the consequence, they are worthy of death who practice such things. In this text, we see the seriousness with which God regards these practices. Any questions or comments on these verses, in particular, from verses 26 through verse 32? No? Beginning in verse 1 of chapter 2, we see a different audience, I believe, addressed. I think that the thought here changes to those who are Jews and their attitude toward those who were Gentiles. He says, "Wherefore, thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest." Let's pause there. He's just identified the Gentiles in chapter 1 as being without excuse. In chapter 1, what is it? Verse 20. The Gentiles were without excuse because they saw the glory of God in His creation. They saw His everlasting power and divinity. But these Jews in Romans chapter 2, who had the law, were likewise without excuse. He says, "O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest does practice the same thing." The Jew who would look at the Gentile and say, "We have the law. You don't have a codified law like we the Jews have. But look at the things that you're practicing. Look at the horror of the things that you're doing." But the writer says to the Jew, "You're practicing the same things." Open your Bible to Matthew the 7th chapter. I want to notice a text with you beginning in verse 1 that is often quoted, and I believe misapplied. In Matthew the 7th chapter in verse 1, the writer says, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." Was the Jews' judgment of the Gentiles wrong in and of itself? No, it was not. Hold your finger there at Matthew 7. We're not through with it. But in John chapter 7 in verse 24, John commands, "Judge righteous judgment. Judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment." John 7, verse 24. Some judgments are commanded, but judgments that are commanded are righteous judgments. The Jews in Romans chapter 2, when they looked at the Gentiles and made judgments, their judgment was not righteous. Well, why? He said, "For you practice the same things that you condemn the Gentiles for practicing." Now going back to Matthew chapter 7, let's look at the inconsistency that existed. In Matthew chapter 7, he says, "Judge not that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured unto you. Now, what is the standard of judgment that I apply unto somebody else? The same standard that I ought to apply to myself. You see, if I'm not applying the standard to myself that I apply to somebody else, then I'm judging, and I ought not be judging, according to Matthew chapter 7. I'm engaged in hypocritical judgment. And the writer goes on to illustrate. In verse 2 or verse 3 of Matthew 7, he says, "And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considereth not the beam that is in thine own eye?" Who's reading this morning from the New American Standard Translation? Anyone? Ken, what's it say in verse 3? The New American Standard. Oh, okay. Who has Matthew 7? Go ahead, if you would, back in the back. That's interesting to me. You've got a speck in your brother's eye, but you've got the whole plank in your own eye. And the writer is describing the inconsistency of that. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, and you don't see the whole plank that's in your own eye? And what is then the consistency of that? What is the brother to do? He's to remove the plank from his own eye so that he can see clearly to see the speck that is in his brother's eye. Now, does that mean he's not to look for the speck that's in his brother's eye? Does it mean he's not to make any judgments at all? Well, no. He is to make righteous judgment, we see in John 7, verse 24. But in order for his judgment to be righteous judgment, he must apply the same standard to himself that he applies to somebody else. If not, he plays the part of a hypocrite. And when the writer says in Matthew 7, verse 1, "Judge not that ye be not judged," he's not forbidding all judgment. But what he is forbidding is hypocritical judgment. You apply to yourself the very same standard that you apply to somebody else. Don't play the part of the hypocrite. Now in verse 1 of chapter 2, the book of Romans once again. Romans chapter 2, verse 1. I got 10 seconds. We'll begin in Romans chapter 2 in our next study. Next Lord's Day morning, we'll begin in Romans chapter 2.
Should I give you like 12 seconds warning? Instead of 10.
10 is fine. No, I don't want that open.
All right.